Right. I was asked to give a review talk, an introduction to string field theory. This is one of the two topics we're going to be focusing on this workshop. So it's for the first few weeks, we're going to be having some work done here on string field theory and on pure spinners. So I was asked to talk about string field theory and give an overview and an introduction to what's going on. So certainly there's room to get very technical here, but I will not do so to a large degree, and whatever I'll be getting into some concrete details, I hope they will be relatively self-contained for people that have some acquaintance with the ideas of string theory. So please interrupt if you have questions or some comments or disagree with things that I'm saying or whatever. So I'll begin by talking about the string field. So, what is the string field? So, in order to describe what the string field is, you really don't have to know much more than what is a string background. So whenever you have a string background, or a tractable string background at least, you have a conformal field theory. CFT, a two-dimensional conformal field theory. This two-dimensional conformal field theory is a strict conformal field theory, and many times can be described as a product of a conformal field theory in the matter sector tensored with a CFT in the ghost sector. These are two-dimensional ghosts having to do with reparameterizations of the world sheet. So if you know what a string background is, you are in the possession of some conformal field theory, typically matter times ghost. And with this conformal field theory comes, naturally, the state space of the conformal field theory, the set of all states. So we can call that HCFT. It's the state space. Now, this state space is infinite dimensional. In a typical conformal field theory, you may have a finite set of primaries, perhaps, but you have infinite set of descendants, and primaries plus descendants form an infinite set, so this is an infinite dimensional vector space. So here is a vector space. H for Hilbert space is a misnomer, because you have ghosts, and therefore the inner products are not positive definite, but precisely speaking, it's just a state space. And so you have a vector space. And you can speak of this vector space as a set of states, or in conformal field theory, we're familiar by the state operator correspondence, you can talk about a set of operators as well. It's just a matter of language. The fact is that you have a vector space. So it's an infinite dimensional vector space. And now you can know what a string field is. A string field, psi, or phi sometimes, depending. Typically, we've been using phi for open strings and psi for closed strings. At this moment, it doesn't matter what I'm talking about. If you were doing open strings, this would include a boundary conformal field theory. the string field is nothing else than a vector in this state space. In fact, it's a vector in this state space, or sometimes in some linear subspace of HCFT. That is, this HCFT might sometimes be a little too large, and the string field is just a vector. So that is a string field, and at first sight, this sounds a little shocking, because the basic dynamical field is just some sort of vector in a linear vector space. This doesn't look anything like a metric, for example. A metric is an object, it's a matrix, but it has non-linear constraints having to do with signatures and positive definite conditions. In string field theory, where the metric will arise, is part of a vector space. Gauge fields, all familiar fields, tensor fields, are all part of a vector space. So, more intuitively speaking, people write phi, they can write it as a state, as a sum of a basis vector, some coefficients times basis vectors, where these are basis vectors. Or HCFT. So far, that's all what the string field is. And if you use the state associated with a tachyon, the coefficient here is the space-time tachyon field. You have the vertex operator for the graviton. Here the coefficient is the graviton field. So in a sense, this is an act. If you're going to write an action, you're going to be writing an action for this vector, which at the end of the day is an action for this component, which, if you want, you can associate with target space vector field. So what is the action? The action is a nonlinear function of this vector. Set phi. So this action should be constructed, and that's what we're going to describe to some degree, but in principle it takes HCFT to the real numbers. So you can see here that we've so far been using very intensively the conformal field theory vector space. Now, string perturbation theory should come from this action when you think of the vector or the string field as small and you do perturbation theory. But the whole idea of writing an action is going beyond perturbation theory, and therefore in this action, we are interested in the case when this phi is not small. So it's not treated as a fluctuation. So whether this action has any power beyond conformal field theory or conventional definitions of string theory is the question of whether you can trust this action for large string fields. For example, one thing you always want to do with an action is find a classical solution. A classical solution would be a critical point of this action in which this field could have a significant expectation value. That is, these coefficients need not be parametrically small. So if you have classical solutions that are not small, then you have something that has gone beyond conformal field theory. Now, this is essentially what we're going to describe here. We're going to try to describe a little more concretely how you construct actions and what can be done with them. So, in a way of introduction, I still want to discuss a little what has been understood by doing string field theory, what has been possible to do, sort of in the past, in the recent past, and what's going on now that is going to be discussed in this workshop. So are there any questions or comments so far? Yeah, very different. Yeah. I don't think so. Not familiar ones like gravity or gauge theory, certainly. Yes, or they start with a somewhat more geometrical interpretation of what each component field is. Here, in some sense, the conformal field theory plays a critical role. And as we will see, all of the construction of this action is based on conformal field theory. A little more sophisticated conformal field theory, because if you have to treat with the operators that are not primaries, you need to be a little more careful how you do conformal field theory with them. It's more delicate, as you will see. Zero mode of what? Right. Well, it's ordinary field theory, but a little strange in the sense that it would still have a higher derivatives and things like that. Even if you restrict yourself to massless fields, for example, and truncate to massless fields, you will still have an unusual derivative structure. Alpha prime structure will not be conventional. That's right. Well, you know, I don't know, it may seem similar to you, but you know very well that, for example, if you're describing closed string theory, you will have in the string field an H mu nu field, an alpha minus 1 mu, an alpha tilde minus 1 nu, C1 bar, a state of some momentum. And this graviton fluctuation just can be as large as it can be. It's part of a vector field. There's no metric initially here, and certainly gravity appears quite differently from what we're accustomed. Yes?
You already have quantum mechanics in the
Well, this action is going to be a quantum action, and the way we're going to think of it is that we're going to do path integral quantization of this action. All right, so let me briefly talk a little bit about things that were done with string field theory. So some achievements. Before 2000, year 2000, certainly it brought about the fundamental role of the Q, which is the BRST operator, so Q is a very interesting operator. It's used, was viewed as a somewhat technical operator used for the quantization of gauge theories, but when used to quantize and think of the gauge system of the world sheet, this operator suddenly became very important. In fact, was necessary to formulate free gauge fixed string field theories. And that was Warren Siegel in 84. So the use of this operator, so what is Q? Well, in terms of this sort of what Warren says, a little empty set of conventions here, Q so far you should view just as an operator that takes HCFT to HCFT, and with Q squared equals zero. At any rate, this operator that could be constructed and was constructed by Kato and Ogawa was used by Siegel in 84 to construct free string field theories. Q was sort of cut in pieces and used to sort of reassemble a gauge invariant field theory. But this was done actually very nicely by Witten, who did gauge invariant theory, open string theory. And perhaps the crucial insight here was that if you wanted a free action, the equation of motion would be just as simple as Q on this phi vector equals zero. This is the equation of motion for free strings. Q phi equals zero. Now, this tied very nicely with ideas of cohomology, so you could describe the physical spectrum, as the set of phis that satisfy Q phi equals zero, and phi is considered equivalent to another phi if they differ by Q of something. So, in fact, the role of Q indeed came from the free string theory and from attempts to formulate the string field theory, and eventually became the covariant way of defining the spectrum of string theory. So this is a rather important result and is used all over, and we'll see a few variations on it very soon. Another thing that was interesting that followed from string field theory is new parametrizations of the moduli spaces of Riemann surfaces. The string theory gives you an algorithmic way of building the perturbation theory with Feynman rules. So it actually tells you how you're supposed to build the amplitudes by putting together strips and joining them with vertices. We knew from the fact that string amplitudes would be integrals over the moduli space of Riemann surfaces, all the inequivalent Riemann surfaces. And therefore, we expected that the string field theory would produce every Riemann surface once and only once. And this was done by the string field theory and, in fact, showed new ways of producing this set of all Riemann surfaces. Now, it may sound a little like, okay, well, it's a nice result, but it's no practical use. Indeed, at this moment, probably it's not enormous, easily used, but if you one day would have to do a for loops computation in closed string theory, you would find that the hardest part of your problem, if you want to get a number out of it, not to prove it's finite or infinite, is parameterizing the moduli space of genus 4 Riemann surfaces. And you would not find any easy way to do it, perhaps except with the one that the string field theory would give you. It would produce the moduli space automatically for you. If you try to obtain the moduli space in any other way, Fuchsian parameterizations, other parameterizations, a mess. In fact, it's fairly undoable. So it's, in principle, an interesting thing that this parameterization of the moduli space at genus 1, at genus 2, is nothing you really need to survive. But if you one day needed to go beyond that, you would need it. Brief, I don't want to get into details, but with the string field theory, you can sort of prove, and it was done in the past, this simple statement that people had always in mind. That is, we've mentioned that we start with some conformal field theory and write a string field theory. Now, we all believe that if you just used another conformal field theory, this nearby, with the same type of conformal field theory that is nearby, and you wrote the string field theory, is the same theory around a different background. That's a statement of physical background independence, and this is concrete enough that this can be proven in this formulation. That is, you can take one conformal field theory, another nearby conformal field theory, write the two string field theories, and show that they are related by shifting the string field. So different conformal field theories, related conformal field theories, give you the same string theory. So this is called physical background independence. A close cousin of this is the so-called dilaton theorem, that in closed string theory says that shifting the dilaton changes the string coupling. That's also a little difficult to prove in conformal field theory formulations of string theory, but it can be done in string field theory. So let me then jump to more recent things that are going to be the subject of what we will discuss. So these were things before 2000 and 2000, really. So what happened afterwards? So after 2000, so basically from 2000 to 2003, there was numerical evidence that open string field theory has classical solutions. With large phi. So for the first time, really, in a sense, you could say that all these developments they mentioned before improved on our abilities to do things that we could do in perturbation theory, not well, but we could do them well or better now. This is substantially new, and that was the real aim of a string field theory, finding a solution that is large, and that would tell you that the theory perhaps is a good step towards a complete formulation of string theory. It should be able to obtain solutions that are sufficiently far away. And this was done numerically, and the motivation, numerically, because there were no tools to do it better, and the motivation was sense Taakian conjectures. And in the later review sessions, Martin Schnabel will discuss a little bit the Sen conjectures and how he used them to find a solution. In fact, this period, there was significant analytical developments, analytic developments as well. Open string field theory. Well, then came this big advance by Martin Schnabel, 1205, Martin Schnabel finds the Takian vacuum solution. In a sense, this 20-something, 30-year-old problem of the tachyon of the bosonic string and whether it has a vacuum, the Sen conjectures were the statement that it had a vacuum and at an energy that was related to the D-brain energy. And this is the first analytic solution of string field theory, a large analytic solution, and describes the critical point of the tachyon potential. So this used some of these analytic developments that will be reviewed in the lectures and further ideas as well, and a lot of originality. In 01 of 07, marginal solutions, were found. These are solutions associated with what we call marginal deformations of a conformal field theory. These are actually simpler solutions than the solution that Martin found, and they can be used to describe physical processes such as a tachyon rolling down the potential and a D-brain disintegrating, is described by one of these marginal solutions. And then there's further developments of last year that and that in 07 as well that will be discussed here in the seminars, and perhaps to some degree this will be described by Martin in his lecture, and Yuji Okawa will describe his work and work of others on marginal solutions. So, so this gives you an idea of. Yeah, some of them have, right. Absolutely. One solution is a time-dependent solution that represents D-brain decay. So let's pretty much do the last thing that has to do with setting the stage. And I want to describe what string field theories exist, even. So it has not been too easy to write string field theories. And most of the times, the difficulties have been conceptual. They're not, they seem technical, but you can see each time a string field theory was written that a lot of conceptual things were understood. So here are a set of string field theories that exist at this moment. This set of string field theories. So the oldest and pretty reasonable string field theory that exists is the light cone bosonic string field theory. This is 1974, Taku and Kikawa. and a lot inspired by the work of Mandelstam. So this is a field theory of strings. The next one is covariant, Lorentz covariant, manifestly Lorentz covariant, open bosonic, and this was completed after the work of Siegel and others by Witten in 86. Covariant closed bosonic around 92, and I was involved in that, and there were others as well. Then something funny happens. I'm listing here string field theories that are basically healthy. That is, that have been tested to some degree, and if they have problems, they're so subtle that I don't think they deserve to put a big question mark on this string field theory. So actually, Witten, around 87, wrote a string field theory that is more doubtful and will appear in the set of string field theories that maybe will work one day, but don't quite make it yet. Then comes covariant open superstring. And that's in 95 by Nathan Berkowitz. And last one that presumably is quite safe is heterotic string field theory. It's actually just the Neve-Schwarz sector. And this is 2004 by Okawa, Nathan Berkowitz, and myself. And these are presumably all the string field theories work well. Yes, Nate. Yeah. There is a Ramon sector, but it's not fully Lorentz covariant, if I understand. So Neve-Schwarz sector there too as well. So these are the ones that seem safe. I want to list the ones that don't seem too safe. Light cone, superstring field theory. These have been plagued by contact terms that people have discussed to no end, and I think it's not clear that this is quite good. There's one that we've been involved, vacuum string field theory. It's a rather nice theory, but it seems to lack some good regulator, missing a regulator. But it seemed like a step in the right direction. Then there is the cubic. Well, it was written with a BRST operator that was totally trivial. Didn't use the matter conformal field theory at all. Used just ghosts. And somehow, some properties of it seem to need some regulator based on matter. And that was never done very cleanly or very convincingly. And it was a little stuffy. It was a rather nice theory, though. Then there is cubic open superstring field theory. And that was Witten in 87. And then tried, improved by Thorne, Arefeva, and others. And again, it's not very clear whether it works. There is covariantized light cone string field theories of the Japanese group. It was Hata, Ito, Kugo, Kunitomo, and Okawa. So it's a Japanese group, and this also had some problems that were never resolved. So that's more or less the zoo of things that exist at this moment. And lacking here is a natural or simple description of a type 2 theory. That's probably the most important one that is missing rather dramatically from this list. So, yeah. No, I didn't get into topological field theories. I'm talking about the physical ones at this moment. I don't know precisely what is the list of topological string field theories that exist. Do you know? Maybe. Okay. Yes. Well, in perturbation theory, this one is completely safe. This is almost completely safe. This is completely safe. These ones are a little bit confusing at loops. Not quite done. The three amplitudes, presumably all of those make it quite well, but to loops, the quantities. So I told you that we do path integral quantization, so the loop amplitudes have to be done carefully and by quantizing the theory, introducing ghosts and all these things, and it's not completely clear this is yet done here. Well, yeah. Well, as far as we know so far, you know, things like open superstrings and heterotic strings may be related by dualities. That is not obvious in this picture yet. The open bosonic strings and the bosonic strings and the superstrings seem very different, although there's very beautiful work by Hellermann and that shows that possibly there are transitions, cosmological transitions between them. But in principle, an open string theory cannot exist alone, must produce closed strings at the quantum level. So these two are sort of the same theory in some sense. And Lipkin versus covariant is just different gauge. So in a sense, there's one theory pretty much here, open and closed bosonic strings, and these are open and a certain type of closed. All right. Okay. So needless to say, the most significant developments that have happened in string field theory have been around this one. And that was because we now know enough analytic tools and we can get classical solutions of this theory so that things become possible. Nevertheless, being this an introductory talk, this today and tomorrow, I want to give you a structural feeling about this whole set of theories, what they are and what they're missing. I will put some emphasis now on the open bosonic string because this is the one we're going to use, so it's a good idea that if you're going to stick to more lectures that you get familiar with some of the notation here. I will talk about the closed bosonic string as well because presumably, sometime in the near future, some of these developments will percolate here. Then I will explain to some degree the structure of these two theories as well, but more briefly. I may conclude at the end with some comments about the Lipkin one as well, which is interesting in its own right. And again, I also suspect will become important again fairly soon in the context of cosmological solutions. So I will therefore, unless there are more questions, begin now describing this theory. Today we'll try to describe this theory in some detail and this theory in some detail. Tomorrow, brief discussion of these two and some further developments in open string theory so that you gear to the solutions that were found recently. Yes. I could not tell you what is wrong. It's very complicated. It carries picture-changing operators, but in some fashion that the collisions apparently are safe. Nevertheless, level expansion analysis in those theories has given very inconclusive results and difficult ones. I don't know, maybe Nathan can say more. You know, it's sometimes difficult to see whether the problems really affect you or how serious they are. They seem to be somewhat subtle problems, and despite all these efforts to fix this thing. So let's begin with open strings now. So we'll write the action and describe some of it. So, open bosonic SFT. So, you have a BRST operator, Q. Remember, we have fixed the background, we have a conformal field theory, we have a state space, the string field is a vector in that state space. There is an operator Q that squares to zero, and that will define the physical states. And here is the action, S of phi equals minus 1 over G squared, open string coupling, phi Q phi plus 1/3 phi phi star phi. So I have to define a couple of things here for you to understand what's going on. First, let me remind you of a structure in conformal field theory. If you have a state A, there's an operation called BPZ conjugation. It's not a Hermitian conjugation, it's a linear conjugation that takes kets to bras, to the dual space, so it gives you the state, the bra A. In any conformal field theory, you know how to contract the dual space with the state space to get a number. So this bilinear form, A, B, is defined to be this inner product. So here we have a bilinear form in the state space of the conformal field theory. You put two vectors and out comes a number. The first vector is the operator Q acting on this vector. Here is the dual vector, and that's that. Now, if we want to get a couple of signs right, at least here, so I'm going to give you a couple of conventions that we use to do this, and then you will check, if you've never done, the gauge invariance of this action. And so here are the couple of conventions that you need to know. that if you exchange the order of these states, you get this with a sine factor minus 1 to the AB. What does A here mean? So minus 1 to the A is really minus 1 to the epsilon of A, which is the Grassmannality of A. Epsilon of A is the Grassmannality of A, and it's 0 mod 2 if A is even, and it's 1 mod 2 if A is odd. You might say, why all of a sudden we're talking about even and odd things? And I remind you that the conformal field theory, the CFT, has a ghost sector, CFT matter and CFT ghost. And the ghosts are the ghosts of reparametrization, and they're anti-commuting objects. So suddenly we need to worry about the possibility that these things are even or odd. So in these conventions, you can decide immediately whether the string field should be even or odd. Otherwise, this kinetic term would vanish. For example, you have phi, q phi. Now, let's use this property to reverse the order. Well, it's not guaranteed to be a real number unless you put a reality condition in the string field. And I will tell you what the reality condition is in a second. So, no, it's not guaranteed to be a real number because, as you said, this is a bilinear form and it's not Hermitian conjugation. So there has to be a reality condition. I have one more property here that I should write. QAB is equal to minus 1 to the a qb. So q can be moved, it's an adjoint operator itself up to a sign, can be moved from the brass to the kets. So if you have this, you can first exchange the order, and you get minus 1 to the product of the statistics. Now, the statistics of phi, let's call it phi, the statistics of q phi is phi plus 1 because this is odd. So you don't get a sign because this is always even. Q phi, phi, so this is just q phi, phi. And now you can use the second property to move the q from here to here. It gives you minus times minus 1 to the phi, phi q phi. And you want this to be the same as that, so you deduce that the string field in these conventions is odd. Phi, the classical string field, is odd. Now, that's sort of natural for a classical string field. If you think of the string field, classical string fields are associated with a ghost field, a matter vertex operator, a matter thing, acting on the vacuum. So if we think of the vacuum as being even, this is naturally odd. And it's sort of natural to think of the vacuum as being an even object because it's associated to the operator identity, which is nothing. So phi is odd. If you would write something that is even, it would drop out from this part and perhaps would drop out from this part as well, I think. So we just might as well declare it to be odd. Okay, now comes the last part, the associativity. This is a product, so this is the most delicate part of the definition, but there's something called the product here. So it's star is something that takes two things, two vectors, and gives you another vector. So it's as defined here and as needed here, in fact as needed here, this should be associative. A star B star C equals A star B star C. And it should have a nice interplay with the bilinear form as well. That's another property that should be realized. A B star C is equal without signs A star B and C. So what else should this star product satisfy in order to get a good string field theory? What, couple more things. First, it should have a nice property with respect to the BRST operator. And the most natural thing is that it's a derivative. The BRST operator acts as a derivation on the product. So we must have that Q acting on A star B is equal to QA star B plus minus 1 to the A star QB. Yes. No, no, it's another axiom. Absolutely. The second one doesn't follow from the first. It's a yet another property. So there's this property finally, and we're almost there. If most people would say we're there, but let's be a little more precise. In order to get your signs right, you need to know that the sign of a star product is just the sign or the Grassmannality adds. So it's naive. If you have odd and odd, you get even. And of course, E, the epsilon of QA, is the epsilon of A plus 1. So here you are. You have all the axioms necessary to make this action work. And the reason I cannot yet, of course, prove it works is because I have not described concretely how you produce a star product that is associative and does all these things. But that will come very soon. At this moment, you have all the axioms needed to show that this action makes sense. And to show that, basically, you have this little exercise you could do if you wanted with all the signs that I've given you, that there's a gauge invariance. Where lambda is even, Grassmann even. It has to be because the string field is Grassmann odd, so the infinitesimal gauge transformation is this, and it's a good exercise. Takes a few lines to prove this action is invariant under that. Sorry? I don't need it here. Well, you know, there's this other formulation that Witten used that was looked a little more like Chern-Simons, that used the identity string field more. But this one doesn't need it. It's not part of the algebraic structure. Maybe we can talk about it more. I can clarify it next time. So another thing that you can check is that the equation of motion is Q psi phi plus phi star phi equals 0. That's easier to do. So, all right. What is missing here is a description of the star product. And that's the part that is generally most subtle, and in fact we really need to understand it well in order to understand the developments of the classical solution. So let me describe the star product in a little of detail. So well, here it is. Suppose the only thing I'm really giving you is that you manage to devise inner products that we use it with BPZ conjugation and star products that satisfy this identity, you get the gauge invariant action. And that's it. No more claim. Well, it's unique up to field redefinitions. It's as unique as a Chern-Simons action, for example. So, what is star? So, rather than define star, you can define more easily A times BC. Now, if you know the inner product, which is the BPZ inner product, and if you know how to calculate this number, you've known how to calculate the star product of any two things. You just take basis vectors here and do this. So, in fact, here is the way you're supposed to calculate this. Schematically written, it's sometimes written this way. F1 circle, which means conformal map, A. F2 conformal map, B. F3 conformal map, C. So these are functions that implement conformal maps, and this is a correlator. So what are you supposed to do? Here's a picture. A unit disk. This is open string theory, so the Riemann surface is the unit disk, and this is the boundary where the boundary conditions apply. Now, on this disk, we're going to divide it into three slices like that. Then we're going to mark one point called P1 here, a point called P2 here, and a point called P3 here. I'm going to probably go a little slow on this just to make sure it's understood. So what are we going to try to do? We're going to imagine these states or the corresponding operators inserted at the origin of local coordinates, Psi1. These are open strings, so use the upper half plane, Psi2 and Psi3. So think of the operator A inserted at the origin here. Think of the operator B inserted at the origin here, and the operator C inserted at the origin here. Three operators. Now, you're going to do a conformal map, and here, this is the unit circle, half circle. Here's the unit half circle. Here's the unit half circle. This is a unit disk, 1. Now what you're going to do is define a function F1 that takes this half disk and sticks it in here. So in doing the map, it should map this boundary over here and this boundary into here. So this whole thing should be, in a sense, sort of conformally mapped to produce an, a pizza slice from here and just stuck in here. So this is the conformal map called F1. The conformal map that takes this half disk into this topological half disk. So this point, Q, will go here, Q. This side into here. This side into here. This is the map F1. The map F2 is the one that does the same thing but maps this into this one. The map F3 maps it into here. So, this conformal map is used to take this operator from here and insert it here. The operator here and insert it there. And the operator here and insert it here. And then, once you've done these things, you do the correlator on this surface. The three operators are now sitting here. You can compute the correlator. This is the number, and that defines the star product. So this is a very concrete definition, but it's very precise. And it's operationally useful. You give me three states, you have to do these maps. At the early stages of this game, people were confused enough that people wrote papers with this map, which is a pretty simple map, actually. Leave it to you if you want to do it. It is rather simple. If you have those maps, and they can be done analytically, you can compute this, and you're done. So, in a sense, actually, this whole information about this vertex is encoded by these lines here that have divided the disk into three regions. Because if you have, let me say this, you have a local coordinate over here, and you have any surface, and you say this, P, A, and B, there's a unique map that takes this into this. You see, in general, maps of what are called disks into this have three parameter ambiguities, but you have P goes to P, A goes to A, B goes to B, it's all fixed. So there's a unique map from this to this. So the only thing that is relevant in this picture is just this thing here that tells you how the map is supposed to be done. Now, why do you need this map? This is the key reason. The reason is that your states in the string field theory, that's not here anymore, are not all primary dimension zero operators. So they actually care. They're not conformally invariant states. So whatever answer you will get will depend on this function. If they were be physical on-shell states, the map would not matter. But the map here matters, and it's in fact the key thing in the definition of the theory, this conformal map. Because we claim that with this picture only, you can achieve associativity. And that's another important result, that only with this picture you get a star product that is associative. That, to see it, you have to use a little more intuition here, but you can think of the strings at time equals zero. These are the strings in the past. They evolve until at time equals zero are here. And if you think of the three strings at time equals zero, how they're being joined, one string, the string A, is become this. The string B has become something like that, the string A, B, and the last one that you can think of it as the product is the string C. And that's just the picture of these three strings. Like that. How they're interacting. This color will not be good, I think. Blue might be better. other interacting at time equals zero. Now, once you accept this picture in here, I think I got it right. Once you accept this picture, you can sort of see the associativity quite easily. If you're really multiplying A times B and then times yet another one C, not like here that you're forming the inner product, but a C, A times B is this string, and that times C is this string. The result is this string. And you could do B times C, that forms this string, multiplied by A, would give you the same result. That is the origin of the associativity. You can do A star B star C in two ways. A star B star C. So let me draw the string. A B B star C. B star C is this green one that would go from here to here. B star C. And then times A is this whole red string. And A times B could be the blue one, so it would be times C, it's again the red one. And well, there's no problem of non-associativity as long as you talk about Fock space states. So for any three Fock space states, it will be simple. Now, a state that is non-Fock is a little more complicated geometrically, and it can fail. The associativity can fail. So one certainly profound problem of the string field theory is that nobody has said very clearly what is the set of states beyond Fock space states for which associativity holds. But for many it does, and there are some exceptions for which it doesn't. Well, you have problems with norms anyway because of the ghosts, but things like exponentials of products of oscillators acting on the vacuum, squeeze states, not all. Some are very good, but some, depending on the quadratic form on the top, could be bad. So, probably not. You see, we're going to use some states that are called squeeze states, or some look like coherent states, and they're very good. They are very completely associative, and I don't think they're a problem. Sorry, the angles what? Yes. That's... Yeah, they should be equal. If not, the vertex is sort of going to lose some sort of cyclicity and you're going to have all kinds of problems. So you're not going to be associative either, I think. In fact, I think it's... Yeah. You're saying that you could get an associative product maybe with something like this first state goes here, second state goes here, and the third state goes here. Is that the question? Or different angles? A new product? Yes. Well, if you want to do this properly, then you get too many angles, so you have to do a conformal mapping here to bring them back. So if you're considering iterated products, you have to re-smooth this thing by a conformal map, some power, so that then you will see like four strings, each with angles of 90 or things like that. Yes, no, that's fine. The operators are not conformal invariant, but you can do conformal maps of the whole picture, carrying the operators. Yeah, but you don't... you're not supposed to smooth things really conceptually. This is the way you do a product, and you know, perhaps this is a little misleading, this picture, but... Yeah. Look. Right. Yeah, I think so. That was what I was trying to say, but maybe. Yeah. So let me leave it like that. Let me show you three other pictures of this vertex that you will need and will be useful. So you can do conformal maps of this picture, and things, you know, for example, these lines here, they will look a little different as you do the conformal map. So you do a global conformal map, which is an invariance. So this to another picture, and you pull the local coordinates. So for example, you can do it like this. You can map this whole disk to the upper half plane. And you have A, B, and C here. P1, you get this, the operator A. P2, you get the operator B. And C, you get this operator here. And then in this picture, how do things look? Well, this yellow line, for example, will look like something like this. And then the yellow is for A. So I have it. The red is here, and the blue is here. And the local coordinates look a little like this. A little unrecognizable, but that's the same picture. One that is very popular and will be useful for us is this one that makes perhaps the associativity very clear. A is here, B is here, C is here. This is the point -1/2. This is 1/2, this is 3/2, and this is 5/2. And then A is here, so there's yellow. Look, yellow will be here. Red will be here. And blue will be there. So actually, the local coordinates now look like this. The point Q that was here, the midpoint Q, is over here. And as you can see, you must identify this line with this line. This is a very good picture of the interaction. Three strips like this, glued from here and here. It's conformally equivalent to this one, and you can do it by just taking the logarithm, basically the scaled logarithm of this. Because the logarithm is I times the logarithm, probably, of e to the I theta moves you along the real line, and then you go up, but you go in here. So here is a nice definition. You're multiplying b times c, is putting this strip together with this, times d, another one here, and then the order sort of becomes pretty obvious. So this is a very the picture that we're going to use a lot. It's very funny, in a sense. It's very different from what we usually think of open strings doing it. These half strings have become infinite lines, but this is the same star product. So you could use these maps and calculate on this surface over here. There's one more picture I want to talk about, which is the perhaps conventional picture in which you think of three semi-infinite strips. Here is this A, B, and C. Three semi-infinite strips, and then they are glued at time equals zero. So A was yellow, so here is this thing. There is a map that takes this region or this region to a semi-infinite strip. Then B is red. You would have it here. And the other one is blue. And the way these gluings work is that you're supposed to glue this with this, this with this, and this with this, and assemble it together. This is actually perhaps the most intuitive way. So you have three strings coming from infinity, and at time equals zero, they are glued half by half. That is conformally equivalent to this, and to that. And this is perhaps also the reason people sort of describe the vertex by saying, you glue the half of the right part of the string to the left, to the half, left half of the second, the right half of the disk to the next one, and sort of this picture is supposed to tell you the instruction of how you glue half strings in the infinite strip version. So, enough of those conformal maps. Let me move on then to the next subject for just 10 minutes and we'll conclude. So, we're going to do the basics of the closed string to get started. And so closed bosonic. So the main question here is Q now psi equals zero the correct linearized field equation? Well, you might think that, sure, that's what it's supposed to be. But actually, the answer is that not quite. This is not correct. You would have this and physical states defined by psi similar to psi plus q epsilon, but that's not going to be the answer. The answer is no. And there are many ways in which this has been seen, all of them a little subtle, but nobody believes this is the right equation. So what is the reason for this? Well, if we're talking about string field theory, the reason is sort of clear. In terms of getting a kinetic term, you have to consider that vanishing correlators in the sphere involve C, the ghost, dc, d squared c, c bar, d bar, c bar, d bar squared c bar. These are non-zero. If you're missing any of these operators, you don't get a non-vanishing result. So you need something of ghost number 6. Whatever string field of any ghost number you may try to write, since Q has ghost number 1, this is always going to be of odd ghost numbers, so this will never work. So if you try to write an action whose equation of motion is this, you would fail. So what can you do? Right, but basically what I have to do is add something to the inner product, put something else in there. And that's, of course, what we're going to do. So the clue in all this is that even in this equation, even with q psi equals 0 problem, states with L0 minus L0 bar different from 0 cannot be in the cohomology. So that is easy to show. If you have a state that is annihilated by Q but has non-zero L0 minus L0 bar, it is actually trivial. But in the open string it's fine because you need just ghost number 3, so you achieve it normally with 1, 1, and 1. In the thing you have ghost number 6 and you're stuck. You need something else. So this is a little exercise perhaps you may want to do. It's a two-line proof that a state with L0 minus L0 bar different from 0 cannot be in the cohomology. And for that, you will use that L0 minus L0 bar is the anti-commutator of Q with B0 minus B0 bar, the ghost anti-ghost zero modes. So the answer to this puzzle is that you have to impose an extra condition. And you really want to impose from the beginning that the string field is annihilated by L0 minus L0 bar and annihilated by B0 minus B0 bar. So I mentioned before, you have a conformal field theory state space. You may not be able to write an action on the original space, but some linear subspace. And this is the classic example. You impose these two conditions, and now we're going to see that we can manage just barely to write something that works. So I will write L0 minus L0 bar as just L minus, L0 minus, and B0 minus B0 bar as B0 minus. And we'll have gauge invariances, delta psi equal q lambda, and the same conditions apply to lambda. So we cut the state space completely, so both for fields and for gauge parameters. So B0 minus on lambda equals 0, you will see it's needed, and certainly we want L0 minus on lambda to be 0 as well, because otherwise, if L0 minus on lambda was not 0, L0 and L0 bar commute with Q, because they are themselves Q commutators. So L and L bar commute with Q. So if this had non-zero L0 minus, the field would go out of the original space where it's L0 minus equals 0. So what is the action that works? S kinetic is psi, and I will not use yet an inner product, I will use just brass and ket, C0 minus Q psi. A little different. You need this, and you know, at the end of the day, this is a rather simple argument why you need these conditions that were derived also from topological considerations by people that do conformal field theory. So let's see why that is gauge invariant. Well, if you have delta psi equal q lambda and you vary it here, so you would have delta s equals, the first term you vary it here, so you'll put a lambda, a q, c0 minus q psi, plus a term where you vary this one, but q squared is 0, so I don't need to worry about this. So this is the term that is tricky, and if you look at it for a while, it's sort of not so obvious to see why it vanishes. I don't know the answer. I don't think there's an efficient, a way that is better than this one to get the answer. I think people have done those things, but they're not more natural or anything simpler. But you know, we could look at it again. For this constraint, L0 minus 0 bar is not so much of a problem. It's B0 minus B0 bar that you really need. It's so let's see how it works and then stop for today. Now, so here is how this works. If you have a field like B0 minus lambda equals 0. Remember, B0 minus with C0 minus, the anti-commutator is 1. And this operator squared to 0. B0 squared is 0. So this operator has no cohomology. So if B0 minus on lambda is equal to 0, it means that lambda can be written as B0 minus on something, omega. And this omega will still be annihilated by L0 minus. So here it is, omega B0 minus Q C0 minus Q psi. And now B0 minus must start making its way to the right. Now B0 minus commutator with Q is L0 minus, but L0 minus kills omega, so it can go through the Q safely. Now B0 minus, when it goes through the C0 minus, gives you 1, but then the Q hits the Q and you get 0. Then B0 minus is already here. B0 minus to go through this Q is another L0 minus that gives you 0, and when B0 minus is to the right, kills this, and it's finally 0. So this is 0 by moving this B0 minus all the way to the right. So you've succeeded to write a free action, and the result is that the physical set of states of closed string theory are states annihilated by Q, and states are equivalent up to Q exact pieces, but all of those in the state space that is truncated by this. This is the cohomology problem that defines closed strings, and getting an action for free closed string fields is a way to do it. So tomorrow I will say a few more words about closed strings, then a few words about open superstrings and heterotic strings, and some of those surface states that are needed in the solutions, and that will be it. Thank you.